This is Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell, all talk and all crime. From white-collar suburban dad to bank robber, the true story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. That's tonight on Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Donald Keith Giamanco is prisoner number 1214070 at the Western Missouri Correctional Center. He was a successful independent stock options trader and the loving single father of twin daughters. Suffered financial ruin during the Great Recession, and in 2007, with no money and a foreclosure notice, Keith made the ill-fated decision to rob banks. He eluded law enforcement, became known as the Boonie Hat Bandit. Finally caught after the 12th robbery, he pled guilty to all 12 in federal court, sentenced to 6 years and 4 months. St. Louis County then used his guilty plea and conviction in federal court as evidence against him for 7 robberies that occurred within its jurisdiction. In state court, he was sentenced to 20 years, a clemency effort now underway for what Keith believes is an unjust conviction for the same crimes twice, considered by many a violation of the double jeopardy provision guaranteed in the Constitution. The book out now about the story, Banknotes, the True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit, by Keith's wife, Carolyn Giamanco. She met Keith in prison where she was teaching prisoners at the time. Keith joins us now from the Western Missouri Correctional Center, a.k.a. prison. Thanks to the folks at the Missouri Department of Corrections for setting up the interview, and to Keith's wife, Caroline, who contacted me and urged me to do the interview with someone she believes in. Welcome, Keith. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing very well, Jim, and good evening to yourself and the listeners.
Okay. Right off the bat, tell us how you're holding up.
I'm doing fairly well under the circumstances. I mean, it's difficult being away from my family. I have made a conscious effort not to become a part of the culture that exists that most people are aware of inside the prisons. And I have great support, of course, from Caroline and Elise and Marissa, my two girls. And I would say fairly well under the circumstances would be my answer.
Okay, you have 8.5 years remaining if you don't get clemency until you're up for parole, I guess. There's a 5-year ban on visitation by Caroline, which I guess ends in October, she told me. Does that make it tough? I mean, you must have some great spiritual strength in there.
Oh, absolutely. It's very difficult. And yes, I consider myself grounded very well spiritually, and you know, we turn to God for many things that occur in our life, not only on a day-to-day basis but in the macro sense also, like you said, coping with this and you know, getting through day by day. But not only that, but looking at what worst case scenarios are, and also with hope and prayers for, you know, best case scenarios to happen.
Okay. Tell folks what prison's like. What's a day in the life there? Are you in a max prison still?
No, it's actually considered medium security.
Medium
now.
Security. Okay, tell us what a day's like there.
Oh, well, you know, it's regimented, of course. There are, you know, custody counts. There's recreation periods where there's a gym, library available, those types of things. And, of course, meals are done between certain hours of the day, you know, between, you know, 5:30 and 6 for breakfast, 6:30 for breakfast, and, you know, so on and so forth for lunch and dinner. I do a lot of reading, and I watch some television. We have televisions, of course. And you know, I buy and eat snacks off the canteen, and I don't converse a lot. I do a lot of observing, though, of my surroundings, and not only the surroundings themselves, but personalities, both staff and inmate.
Do you view yourself in any danger there?
No, not on a daily or minute-to-minute basis. I think not being involved socially in the prison system is a good way to stay safe.
Interesting. Now, when you were in a max prison, there was a lot of fear of danger.
Yeah, I don't know about personal fear because of, you know, what I previously just mentioned, the aforementioned, but I think that I observed quite a few things like, you know, stabbings and really bad beatdowns and fights and things like that. And there's a lot of fights, frankly, where I'm at now.
Okay. Wow. All right. This is from the book. No one gets up in the morning with the intention of ruining his life. Tell us what you were thinking, how this happened.
It happened. It was actually, as you know, the book describes, it was, you know, premeditated and thought out and basically, you know, treated as a business transaction, for lack of a better term. It wasn't anything that I did in panic mode. I did research, and my thinking was, is that it had to be a substantial amount of money, and it had to be fast, and nobody could be hurt.
That is one of the things that really hit me, is that you did a lot of research on bank robbery, and you almost made it seem like it's pretty fundamentally easy because of the way that the banks set it up. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, and, you know, I had discussions with the FBI agent that interviewed me about this, and he asked me, you know, of course I was under no obligation to answer, but he asked me, you know, how did you plan all this, and how did you get away with all this? And I told him, I said, you helped me. You're the ones who gave me the information I needed in order to do this on your website. And basically what I did was and this is all described in the book, I think, fairly thoroughly, but what I did was, is I looked at the research, and I mean the website, and researched it, and I looked at how people got caught and the cases that were still open and what they did and what the descriptions were and how some people got caught and how some people didn't.
And basically you also made sure you had no weapon on you, right? And the protocol, I guess, on bank procedure is not to put up any kind of resistance.
That is correct. That is correct. And yeah, I mean, all of those things are available, that type of protocol and procedure. And that's why that I knew a bank was, you know, like the old saying, of course, why did you rob banks? Because that's where the money's at. Hmm. But not only that, there is no resistance, and they're instructed not to put up any resistance. So therefore, you know, there's no weapon necessary, and nobody needs to be hurt.
You're in financial distress big time, and you're devoted to your twin daughters. What was your thinking in terms of the risk seemed so huge that you were going to end up hurting the very people you were trying to help? Was your mind not operating 100% on, you know, were you just under too much stress or what?
Well, I think it wasn't operating 100%. I think that would be safe to say for anybody who would observe this from afar, or any forensic scientist or psychologist. But the fact of the matter is of course, I had no intention of getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the reward at the time for them, I was thinking, was greater than the risk. Of course, in hindsight, of course, I feel a lot different about that. And of course, the girls and I have had discussions about that and what I should have did versus what I did. And I'm so thankful that they still support me and are still with me and are still standing right beside me, not behind me or in front of me, but beside me.
By the way, I have twins. So, in fact, we are going to do an interview with them and Caroline as a second show on this. Have you done psychological insight into yourself? I mean, I know the book says you were a people pleaser. Your dad left when you were really young. Did you put some of those pieces together in your own mind?
Sure. Absolutely. I've had a lot of time to think about those types of things. And, I think it's important, though, that when you're looking at those types of things in hindsight, at least it's important to me, not to make those observations in the scope of trying to place blame on something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to me that people know that I take 100% responsibility for everything that has happened throughout this whole experience. Most importantly, the robberies themselves. Because I think it's important that those were my actions only, and no one else is to be blamed for those.
All right, we're going to talk about it, have you take us through one robbery as an example. But where did the Boonie Hat Bandit name come from?
That was a moniker given by the FBI. And I don't think very many people know that, and they may or may not, but these monikers that are given to people who are robbery suspects are given to the given by a person who specifically does that as at the FBI for anyone who is a suspect in three or more robberies.
I understand.
So actually,
go ahead.
Actually, the name wasn't something that was our brainchild or any kind of publicity stunt or anything like that. It was given by law enforcement authority.
I understand your twins think that hat's pretty ugly ass.
They do. They do. And they are not very fond of the moniker or the name at all.
All right.
They said that from the outset.
Can you take us through one robbery from your mindset to the start to when you're getting in your car and all the stuff you did in the car even? Go ahead.
Well, I think that that in most of them, in a general basis, I had already cased out the bank and made sure that it was close to an interstate highway access and had a parking lot that would be congruent with easily getting out and onto that. So I would already know. I would be prepared with an envelope and a note and somewhat of a disguise, being a hat or my hair dyed or growing a beard beforehand for a few weeks, and then, of course, shaving it off right afterwards. I would basically go into the bank, posing as a customer, walk up, wait in line, if there was a line, walk up to the teller, hand them the note, not say anything, and then take the money and casually walk out and go to my car, which would usually be parked between two high-profile vehicles, so nobody could see what type of car I got in, and I wouldn't go to standalone brick-and-mortar buildings. A lot of times the building itself might be, but it would be adjacent into a large shopping center parking lot, so I could kind of blend in when I got in the car and drove away.
Were you nervous?
I think during the first couple I was, but I wouldn't describe it as nerves. I would describe it more as anxiety. And then after the first couple, I pretty much treated it as a business, something I needed to do in order to meet the bills that were on the table.
Apparently, at one time, you robbed a bank and deposited in another branch of the same bank.
Correct, because I held an account in that bank. And it's a large commercial bank that everybody's familiar with that we're speaking of.
Okay, why 12? Were you going to be able to stop? And finally, was there relief when you were caught, which I think you're going to say not? And I've done a lot with Bernie Madoff, and he was very relieved when he finally got caught.
My answer to that is no, absolutely not. And there was a point, you know, that was what one of the detectives for St. Louis County said to the media after I was caught. And, you know, they said, well, he was relieved, you know, as a matter of fact. Never asked me that, if I was or wasn't. And it was totally a falsehood and incorrect. But I think that relief definitely is not a word. And as far as, yes, I had a stopping point, which I was about $30,000 away from.
How'd you get caught?
And I would have quit at that point. Did you say? I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Jim.
No, go ahead. And you're confident you would have been able to quit. And the question was, how were you caught?
I can guarantee you I would have been able to quit. And I think that that being, you know, a lot of people think that this is something like an addiction, and it's not.
Yeah.
I had a goal that I needed to meet, and when I would have met that goal, I would have quit. And an interesting thing, the judge in St. Louis County, the judge that sentenced me, said that he was confident that if I wouldn't have been caught, that I would have continued doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat and listened, and I said, buddy, you don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here?
How'd you get caught?
Well, there was a vice president at the last bank, of course, that I robbed, which is evident. Actually, it was the last that it was the last one. This is what he claims, because he testified on the stand in the trial. He claims that he told one of his coworkers while he was sitting in his office, "That's the Boonie Hat Bandit, and we're being robbed." And then he ran out, got a description of my vehicle, followed me out, which is totally against bank protocol. Followed me out, got the license number and a description of my vehicle, and they caught me about 2 miles down the road from there.
As we get to our last...
After a short period of time where I gathered my thoughts and just went ahead and pulled over, and of course they had, you know, 50 police cars and 2 helicopters and the whole thing, you know, like it was the crime of the century.
Wow.
But
two minutes to go on this segment. What was the arrest process like and getting booked and all that, and I guess put into a county jail?
Oh, it was very interesting. Actually, I was put into a huge holding tank with after I was I'll call it an interview. Because an interrogation wasn't necessary. And all this is very thorough. Caroline does such a great job.
Yes, she did.
In this book of describing these things and making them very interesting and not mundane, because they weren't, actually. It is a very interesting process. You know, I was put in a big holding tank, and the interesting thing is that they had televisions mounted to poles in this huge holding tank. And, of course, when the local news came on, I was on it. And everybody in there was pointing and looking and, you know, had people wanting me to sign autographs and all kinds of strange things. And, of course, I was not, I don't want to use the word mood, but I certainly wasn't in a humor to entertain those kind of things at that point. Because basically what I was thinking about at that time, because I hadn't been able to call anyone, my daughters,
mm-hmm.
and or my mother, my late mother, who was still alive at the time, to let them know what was going on. And then all of a sudden, bam, I'm on the news. And I thought, okay, the girls probably aren't watching the news because they were, you know, 17 at the time. But my mother most certainly knows. So... And I was kind of bummed out because I wasn't able to let them know what was going on before the media did.
I bet they were pretty stunned. This is Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll get to, was Keith a victim of the justice system, in our next segment. So stay with us.
Robert Reese with the CEO Show Minute here with Jim McCann, CEO and founder of 1-800-Flowers. You're known for great customer service. Give me an example.
We have stories about the extraordinary delivery situations where a fellow in an airport, his girlfriend gave him an ultimatum and said, if you don't propose to me by the time I leave for Paris with my family on vacation, don't call me again. Well, at the last minute, he decided this was a good thing and he shouldn't miss out on it. And he asked if we could engineer delivery to Kennedy Airport on Long Island to get these flowers with a proposal to his girlfriend to say that, in fact, he did want to marry her. So we had a delivery guy make a special arrangements with the Port Authority police to get right to the gate with the bouquet, and he knelt down and he read the card message to her while her mom and dad and her sister stood there, and he read the proposal to her, and he had a cell phone in his hand saying, if the answer is yes, I'm instructed to call Richard and put you on the phone with him. So we have photographs of that situation. It was covered by the local TV station because they got wind of what was going on, and it was a great story.
Thanks, Jim. Robert Reese on the CEO Show Minute.
We're back with Keith Giammanco, suburban dad in prison right now for committing robberies. By the way, you're very articulate, Keith. Are you way above your status there in the prison versus other folks there?
Well, I don't think it's my place to answer that. I think that
you're too modest.
It's the truth, though. I think that everybody has their own niche in society. What I would like to do is basically, like I said, be here as an observer for the public.
Mm-hmm.
And to let them know what's going on with their system and their tax dollars, both in the court system and the penal system. And I think that that's how I can give back to the communities, one of the ways that I can give back and make restitution for what I've done.
Well said, and we'll get to that. Now, we're going to get to how you've been victimized, but is it you understand, obviously, that people's sympathies are not going to be necessarily in your favor, at least in the beginning, right, when you rob a bunch of banks.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and rightfully so. I mean, the crimes themselves are nothing to be boasted about, and they're very serious. And I have apologized many times over and did it in the way that I could articulate it the best. And those apologies are both in print and available verbally to all of society for that. So absolutely. I mean, the crimes are serious, and I expect absolutely no sympathy or empathy for the crimes themselves.
Just asking to be treated fairly, and we're going to get to start talking about that, a double jeopardy issue and ineffective counsel issue. You felt you're sort of like on an assembly line to conviction, right? Tell folks a little bit about the process and how you sort of got stuck with bad lawyers and on and on.
Well, I think that, you know, when a high-profile case like this comes on the media, there's many attorneys that come out of the woodwork to want to represent you, both for fees and pro bono, and because, of course, they want the publicity and to be able to go on camera and in print and say that they're your attorney. So I had to process all those things and all the people and pick what was best. And, of course, we didn't have any money, obviously. It only makes sense that we had no money to pay a high-profile, high-dollar attorney. And some of them approached me and, of course, wanted more money than we could afford. And then the two that I finally settled on, one of them was a younger guy who was very green, but he worked for a very well-known law firm and said that he had their complete backing and their help and their experience and everything, which didn't turn out to be the case. So, and the other older gentleman who has passed away since that represented me was a former federal prosecutor. Well, it turned out that, you know, you can take the lawyer out of prosecution, but you can't take the prosecutor out of the lawyer, which is a whole other subject.
That actually wanted you to lose, right? Or
well, I don't know if they know how to win from the other side. That's, you know, that's the question that I have about that. And we go into that in detail in the book, But anyway, I went ahead and pled in federal court, of course, being told that, oh, once you plea in federal court and you take a sentence, the state is going to drop this. Knowing well that I had studied the whole time I was in the county jail about dual sovereignty and the use thereof and the state's ability to actually prosecute and convict a second time and punish for the same crime, which is obviously a breach of all of our rights.
What is dual sovereignty? Because it's sort of unknown. It seems completely in conflict, obviously, with double jeopardy.
It is. It is. It's actually a doctrine that was written in the early 1800s to basically settle a case that was a financial case out of Maryland. And the way they're using it today, basically what happened there is somebody stole money from the city of Baltimore, the state of Maryland, and the federal government, and they all wanted a piece of them. So this was a way to convict that person. And we're talking about 1833 here, so it wasn't like yesterday that this happened. But the Supreme Court has upheld it in cases like bank robbery, where both the state and the federal government have jurisdiction to let them both convict and punish. There was a case in 1959 called Barkas versus Illinois, and it was upheld again in 1973 in a case that is Heath versus Alabama, I believe it is. But anyway, this is basically something that has been upheld, and wrongfully so, in everybody's opinion that we've ever asked this publicly.
The was law enforcement, why were they so hostile to you? Because you embarrassed them by this, or what? Because you seemed to get, as you know, just poor treatment throughout this.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that that's the case, and it was never meant to be that way. And why would, okay, I kind of liken it to, why would, other than basically Bob McCullough, the county prosecutor in St. Louis County, is an attention fiend himself. He loves the media and loves being on the media. So he was going to use this doctrine, which is very rarely used in not only in the country, but in this state itself. As a matter of fact, there's 26 states that there is a law against prosecutors prosecuting a second time when the federal government's already convicted for the same crime. And most of the other states that don't have a law, they generally don't practice it anyway. And there were five robberies in the neighboring county that I committed in St. Charles County, and they referred it over to the feds and didn't prosecute me.
Interesting.
So
why, Keith, would, aside from the question of why you were tried in both courts, how could they come up with a six-year sentence in the feds and a 20-year sentence in the state?
Well, the sentencing matrices are a lot different. I mean, okay, you know, a first-degree robbery in which we fought that it was a first-degree robbery versus a second-degree robbery. And again, all of this stuff is in Banknotes, the True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit, how this all happened. And I think people, and we are talking about this and doing this for everyone, not just for us, because I don't think people understand how many rights that they have constitutionally have been lost through case law and Supreme Court rulings over the years. And you don't know until this happens to you. But I believe that the sentencing matrix, I know that the sentencing matrix for the federal government is cut and dry, and I pled to that. And then the maximum that I could have got under the sentencing guidelines in under the federal sentencing matrix was 71 months. I mean, I'm sorry, 81 months.
Mm-hmm.
And she sentenced me to 76, which was right in the middle of the guidelines there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but first-degree robbery in the state of Missouri carries 10 years to 30 years to life. So I was looking at being exposed to a possible life sentence for the same thing I got 6 years and 4 months for in the federal courts.
Wow.
So that's not very congruent, is it? Is it? I mean, I asked the question. It's just, I think it's one of the problems that we have in this state is excessive sentencing, along with the same mandatory minimum requirement as the federal government.
Which is 85%.
Yes, that is correct. And that's a whole other fight that we're fighting right now.
Yes,
is the excessive sentence with the mandatory minimum attached to it.
So let me ask you, was it a mistake not to plead in the state court? And you had lawyers that apparently didn't even prep right for the defense.
Correct, because they thought that I would be bullied into pleading by them and the judge and the prosecutor. And, of course, it wasn't a mistake. I did the right thing through and through, because if I would have pled, okay, first of all, the state prosecutor did not offer me a plea bargain with a specific amount of years. They wanted me to plea open or mm-hmm. blind in front of the judge. And I refused to do it. I wasn't exposing myself to a judge that I knew was biased against me to a 30-year or a life sentence, because I would have got it. I was much better off taking the chance with 12 jurors of my peers.
And obviously, you had no chance of being found innocent, right? Because you already found guilty in the Fed court.
Well, absolutely. And even if we could have fought this case on a robbery-to-robbery basis, mm-hmm. by law in Missouri, they are allowed to use my federal plea for these robberies against me. So, I mean, how is that a fair trial? I ask the question.
So are you appealing on ineffective counsel as well?
Correct. Absolutely, I am. I'm definitely appealing on ineffective counsel because they were ill-prepared. They tried to abandon me. I tried to let them go, and the judge would have none of it. So basically what we had was we had a client who wasn't satisfied with his attorneys and an attorneys that didn't want to work for their client and were made to by the judge, which under Missouri law, the client has the right to terminate his attorneys at any time during the process.
Do you were your rights to a speedy trial violated?
Absolutely, they definitely were. They, you know, a federal law says that you have 8 months to try and defend it. I never continued the case one time, nor did my attorneys, and the state continued the case 7 times. I was in the county jail waiting for trial, personally ready to go to trial, whether my attorneys were or not, for 23 months.
Wow.
And of course, this whole time, the federal proceedings were going on. So I contend that, and it's obvious through evidence, because the docket even says that they asked for continuances pending outcome of federal case. So therefore, they were delaying the case in order to have an outcome in the federal courts so they could use it against me in the state courts.
Wow. All right, we're going to return in our last segment to where the process is and what they're trying to do to get fairness. But I want to talk a little bit about family now, the importance of that. Your twins stuck by you. Tell us how you met Caroline, and then somehow you end up in the hole in basically isolation with no violation history there inside a prison.
Absolutely, and I still have no violation history because they couldn't find any wrongdoing between us. I applied for a job as a tutor in the adult education program, also known as GED, in the prison system to basically help tutor and mentor other inmates through to get their high school equivalency. And Caroline hired me. She was working as the teacher in the classroom. And we got to know each other. We talked about current events, our family, and, of course, curriculum with the students, and we very simply, not intending to, we fell in love. And once I think that the staff members thought that there was things going on that weren't, there was nothing, and the investigator himself spent months, 4.5 months investigating this, and of course there's cameras all over the place, so they had nothing. So I sat in what's called administrative segregation, or the hole, for four months, the better part of 4 months anyway.
Pretty brutal, right, those conditions?
Oh yeah, the conditions definitely are brutal. I mean, they're complaining. I mean, you shower once every 3 days. You get your 3 meals a day shoved at you through a chuck hole. You can go outside for an hour at a time every other day.
A lot of brutality,
and
too.
And then, of course, it's in like a dog cage where you can go outside. So,
and there's a lot
like,
of
literally
a lot of stuff you can read in the book about what goes on there, right, with prisoners, et cetera.
Absolutely. And I think people will be very interested in reading that. At least I hope so. And like I said, Caroline did such a wonderful job.
Good writer. Now, let me ask you this, though. Let's talk next about the twins. How did they support you? And they were key in as character witnesses, right?
Oh, absolutely. In the trial, I mean, you know, like I said in the book, I mean, they saved my bacon as far as sentencing goes, because in the sentencing phase of the state trial, they testified on my behalf, of course, as a character witness. And the jury, some of the jury members even told them afterwards that they loved them and they were definitely credible and believable about the kind of person and who I am. And, of course, the jurors were misled about what they were actually sentencing me to, which is all in the book. I think people will find that very interesting. But, you know, family is everything. And Elise actually reiterated that fact to me the other day on the phone, and it is so true, and I am so thankful.
Okay,
to God and to them for sticking by me. And you know what it's like to have twins. I mean, it's a special thing.
Yeah, it's an amazing.
And they have a special connection that even we don't understand as parents.
That's exactly right. And they'll cut us out if they stick together, put it that way.
No question about it. I mean, I can describe stories when they were kids where I was actually punishing one of them for doing something to the one of them, the other one, and then the other one would come to their defense.
Oh, every time. But it was worse. What even worse is they might be fighting with each other, and as soon as we'd said something, boom, they were together against us.
Absolutely. And that's basically what I'm describing. You did a better job of articulating it, but I mean, it's such a wonderful thing to even observe.
Okay.
It really is.
As we get down
and
to
I love them to pieces.
Last minute, so I guess we have to be quick here. You talked about the importance of family. Were you abandoned by the rest of your family and all your friends?
Yes. Other than one close friend, and my immediate family has completely abandoned me, and I have one cousin that occasionally writes me, and I write her back out on the West Coast. But yes, abandoned by a stigma, which Caroline describes in her second book called Guilty Hearts.
You're listening to Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We've got our final segment coming up, Justice and Criminal Reform. Talking with Keith Giamanco, victim of double jeopardy in a Missouri prison right now. And that's my first question. What are the next steps you're taking in the process?
Well, Caroline has just launched a clemency effort. And, of course, with the girls and some people who are definitely sympathetic to having their own rights, not only mine, but their own rights violated by this second conviction. So there's a wonderful clemency effort underway through postcards, petitions, emails to the governor's office and to legislators.
Is that for excessive sentencing or for the double jeopardy? What's it focused on exactly?
It's basically focused on the double jeopardy issue, but it's also for excessive sentencing in comparison to the federal sentence.
Yeah.
Now, people, of course, can go online to freekeithgiamaco.com and look up all of the things and the reasons as to why we are looking to have this clemency granted. Now, the second thing is there's also a federal appeal that was formulated by Caroline, myself, and a wonderful attorney named Kevin Snyder that we have hired that was filed about 3.5 years ago. So the federal judge is still reviewing these claims of double jeopardy, right to a speedy trial, ineffective assistance of counsel, and all of these. You know, there's actually 21 claims that we put into 6 for the appeal to the federal judge. So it's still under review.
Well, how much chance do you think you have of winning that?
I hate to put a percentage on it. What I can tell you is that we formulated some of the claims with outside of the box type of questions towards the system and the law, where there is no precedence set on the way that we have formulated these claims. So I would like to think that under an objective review, that we have a pretty good chance.
Interesting. The 85% mandatory minimum, you're trying to reduce that too, and you make some good points in the book that there's no incentive for a prisoner to try and rehabilitate himself if he knows he's stuck for, you know, the vast majority of the sentence.
Absolutely not. And I mean, and that's just one of the things that there's no incentive for. I mean, make no mistake, our penal systems in this country are not about rehabilitation, no matter what they claim. People need to stop drinking the Kool-Aid. I'm here, I observe it, I see it. And it has nothing to do with rehabilitation. It's all about keeping their lemonade stand open. They love the revolving door, where people keep coming back in a high recidivism rate.
Jeez.
It's called job security. It's called a rural jobs program. But yes, we are working on trying to get the it's basically an unfunded mandate at this point, because the states implemented the 85% mandatory minimum on A and B felonies in order to get federal monies that was offered for doing so. But those federal monies have long since dried up, like 5 years ago. So the states, and in Missouri's case, the Missouri taxpayer is being strapped with an entire bill for people who have 30-year sentences at 85%, that is, like I said, an unfunded mandate now.
Keith, there's folks in prison that obviously that can be rehabilitated like yourself. What percentage of the people you think should even be there beyond some time, obviously, of serving their crime?
I would say that everybody's sentence that is, I would say, that falls under an A or a B felony should probably be reduced quite a bit. I would say 30% of the people that are in prison now that are serving extended sentences, let's say 15 years or more,
mm-hmm.
are as ready as they're going to be to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Plain and simple.
Is the political climate in Missouri, do you think, will be not hostile to the clemency effort?
I think that people are willing to look at an individual case more than they are an issue like the 85%. It's unfortunate because the legislators are afraid. They have, as Caroline calls it, Chicken Little syndrome. They yeah. are afraid to attack something that is a burden to the taxpayer and actually enhances the risk to public safety versus helps it. But in the name of public safety, they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole because they don't know how to, I guess they don't know how to articulate it to their constituents that this is helpful to get somebody ready for society faster and get them back out there instead of being a part of this violent, hateful, criminal culture that we call prison.
How much contact now do you have with the girls and Caroline?
Oh, constant. I mean, I talk to Caroline several times each day.
Oh, you do?
And I talk,
do you have email with them?
They can email me. I can't email them.
Okay.
They send me letters and cards, and like I said, I have phone contact with them on a daily basis.
Which keeps you going, right?
Oh, no question.
All right, in the last minute, one of the interesting comments is that you feel you became whole and free, but you were in prison. Explain that.
Oh, absolutely. Through the love of my family and meeting Caroline and us becoming one and having a family unit formed and supporting one another, I am so much freer than I was trying to negotiate and navigate life, raising kids, and finding out who I was as a single person, which was lost, obviously. And I am much freer now to be who I am in an honest way to everybody than I've ever been in my entire life.
And you're all right, or you've gotten over the fact that, so many of your folks, from your family even to friends, have abandoned you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, life has to go on. We have to move on with things. And I certainly am not one that is going to look back and, I have no hate towards them and no animosity. I just, Caroline and the girls are much more adamant about that than I am, and rightfully so. I don't disagree with them, but I think our focus should be on what's going to happen the next hour, the next day, the next month, and so forth.
And I say you have a heck of a team with the three of them, and it would look like a heck of a case with the way that that the system has treated you. I want to thank Keith Giamanco. We, again, are going to have a second interview with his wife, Caroline, his twin daughters, Marissa and Elise. We'll get the story from their perspective as well. Caroline's book is Banknotes, The True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. What's your website again for the clemency?
It's www.freekeithgiamanco.com.
And spell Giamanco for folks.
G-I-A-double-M as in Mary. A-N-C-O.
All righty. We appreciate your time. This has been Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll see everybody again next Sunday at 6 p.m. for another edition of Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell.